Welcome to Goals Question Time, where I interview leading executives driving innovation, venturing, and strategic change.
This is part one of a two-part discussion with Tony Askew of REV Ventures. In part one, he gives an introduction to REV. In part two, we discuss the impact and mitigation of the pandemic. Hi, welcome. I'm Andrew Gall. This is one of a series of discussions with executives who are leading strategic change, innovation, and venturing. We will hear from them with about an introduction to themselves and their organisation, and we will then be discussing the impact and the mitigation of this pandemic crisis. In the live sessions, we have questions and in-depth discussions with senior peers during this session. We have now edited out those sort of discussions for confidentiality of those participants. The resources and podcasts are available with videos on the Aim of Our Resources website. Please enjoy, make comments, and do get in touch. Thank you.
So it's really about helping the CVC community understand what's happening in this big, massive disruption that's sort of come with COVID. So that's the main objective and that with it. And people like yourself, Tony, have been around in this space 20 plus years. And the objective is really to share some stories. And
the REV used to be known as Reed Elsevier Ventures, hence the REV, is the single LP fund, where the single LP is RELX Group. So there's been a few changes of names across the era. So if I can just level set on that. I co-founded this in 2000 with my partner. We were both at the time at SoftBank, the first time that Masayoshi Son was deploying capital kind of globally to create the market leaders and fuel them for rapid international success. And during 2000, we had the dot-com crisis, of course. So it was interesting being an investor at SoftBank as we were beginning to triage that portfolio of what was very aligned with Yahoo and was going to suffer along with Yahoo and what would have some independent legs. And in the midst of that, we came in contact with what was then known as Reed Elsevier, which has morphed from being a largely a print-based publisher of information to a data and analytics market leader globally, operating in multiple verticals, helping professionals and business people make better decisions through the use of data and analytics. So that's been a remarkable journey, and one that actually should be kind of more covered and better written about over that period, because it's one of the few organizations on certainly on the FTSE and I think in the global 2000 worldwide that has undergone a fundamental reinvention journey, and that where much of what was of business models and distribution and format has been replaced. So If you look back when I came on board in 2000, roughly 75-80% of the business was print based, which is quite phenomenal when you think now it's less than 10% is print-based. And through that period, the rationale for investing as an LP in a single fund was they knew that they were beginning a journey. In those days, it was called to print to electronic migration or print to digital migration. And of course, we knew that there was going to go much further than that. But that was the emphasis. And you were thinking, AJ, say about how and when Avon should start to think about how it can get involved with early stage. Well, the shock that Reed Elsevier had was it was written up at the end of the 90s as a possible early contender to be entirely disintermediated by the internet, and realized that it needed to very, very much more sharply and quickly reinvent. And one of the components of that reinvention was having a better understanding of what was happening and what was coming at it from the private markets. And the way to think about that, and what we talked about with them, was, you know, you've got entrepreneurs that are betting their career capital and VCs betting their financial capital on finding ways to disrupt and reinvent the industry before you. And traditional organizations are very much slower to reinvent because they've got, you know, existing businesses, existing business models, existing relationships with customers, and of course a talent pool. And new companies can start from scratch on what that new blueprint should look like.
Yeah. So can I chip in there, Tony, as well, just to re-emphasize that? I think it's a very good example there. Reed Elsevier transformed. What I'm seeing at the moment around retail, around fashion, and probably in your area, Jose, beauty, you know, the model is being accelerated now with the decline of the retail high street and the change in delivery and the change with online vloggers and sort of stuff like that. That, you know, I think we're probably at this disruption point as well for some of the industries and areas you're in, and re-emphasizing this is a time to be looking outside and that as well, in terms of the entrepreneurs and the tech that's going to be driving this next wave now.
That's right. And,
yeah, 100%.
And you know, as we think about that now, if you kind of wind it forward, you know, you think the change that Reed Elsevier was looking at was largely that they felt that a large threat was coming from this technology transfer, you know, from print to digital, the need to re-platform. But actually, over the period, actually, it's become, you know, I think there are three dimensions across that reinvention, which is one is obviously the technology lens. And then the second wave is, of course, the business model and how the business model's changed, partly because of technology, but also partly because consumers or the consumption patterns change. And then finally, which is, I think, is a very big transformation and reinvention hurdle, which is the talent pools and how the talent pools have the requirements of the talent pool to develop a reinvented business are, you know, that one, they're often different kinds of talent. They often live in different places and often thirdly want to work for different companies than the incumbents. And that has been a journey also that I think wasn't quite as obvious in that first period that we were in, where it was clearly a technology and platform. And so when we started really focused on the technology layer. So our first investments were around content replatforming. So things like natural language search, peer-to-peer content networking, unstructured data management, those kinds of things. And then we moved into sort of structured data environments and how structured data was moving things from being kind of the editorialized approach with humans as editors into data, into analytics and derivative data sets that would then be deployed in decision-making environments through workflow solutions that you would be selling as opposed to traditional sort of printed information. So there was a period of time in that early part of the 2000s where the rapid adoption of new content technologies was really changing the expectation of the customers as exactly how they could consume that data. So the publishing handoff used to be extremely high level. It used to be, you know, we have taken all these editors to create some curated set of static information which you can use as reference material. And that as that started to go online, it needed to come to life, and it needed to be much more a movable lens on movable data types. So you have now these days, you have the notion of real-time data kind of extracted at source from sensors and sense-making equipment that now needs to be passed up into a kind of a movable lens AI machine learning environment that delivers automated insight from the pattern recognition and from the instruction set that the logical environment's got, as well as enabling humans to make better decisions. So kind of where we've moved very quickly to in the last 20 years is away from sort of static information in static environments that is human curated to machine generated high throughput augmented intelligence and augmented interface environments where the humans are being supercharged by the environment, not just from the information. And that's kind of the era that we're now in. So that was the sort of foundational principle of that. So when we started, we were seeded with a $100 million fund, and we started to invest in content enabling technologies. And our focus at that time was mostly in the US. So our US portfolio started to build quite dramatically. And we actually had less investments here in the UK and across Europe. Where we are now, we've got sort of just less than 50 investments worldwide we've made over that period. We've got roughly 17 now that are still active. We've sold the majority of those. We've listed one, sold the majority of those. We've only had four that have gone genuinely out of business, which we're actually quite proud of. 90% of the portfolio has been in the United States, half of that in Silicon Valley. The rest dotted around the US, a couple in Boston, New York, Seattle, Los Angeles, Midwest. Outside the US in Tel Aviv, Berlin, London, and actually one in Perth, Australia, of all places. So we actually have a very kind of wide footprint of locations and a very broad waterfront of sectors that we look at, because two-thirds of what we are typically investing in are in these sort of vertical reinvention plays. So things like in healthcare, in legal, in education, we've done stuff in finance, agriculture. And a third of what we've done is in horizontal technologies, where you're building a new data platform, new analytic environment, using AI and machine learning as tools. So that's how we think about our portfolio. Over those years, we have we've managed to make money in each part of those, you know, that of that equation, such that where we are now is this is and has been for some time a fully self-perpetuating profitable fund, in that it effectively is free to RELX because of the distributions that we've made from the successful exits that we've had, and we've still got just under half the portfolio still active. So we're very kind of pleased with that. And along the way, we've been fortunate enough to get into some category leaders. So in the early part of the portfolio, we got into some things which were early movers in content replatforming, such as Insight, which we sold to Business Objects, or SRD, which became the threat and fraud detection division of IBM, Cyperion, which we sold to Informatica, so Netly, which we sold to Akamai, which was application delivery, and then we met Palantir at a very early stage. So we're one of the earliest investors in Palantir, which of course is coming to the fore at the moment as is the platform of choice to understand how to better allocate resources during the COVID epidemic in healthcare, national healthcare environments throughout the world. And then more recently, we've invested in some category leaders such as Babbel for language learning, and Recorded Future for cyber threat intelligence, which we successfully sold actually to Insight Partners last year for just under $800 million in a few short years, showing how good both cyber is as a category, and also how relevant it is. But also showing the superb execution of Chris and his team at Recorded Future. So there's two partners, and has been since the beginning, the two core partners. And we therefore we've made all the investments between the two of us. So we're actually a very stable team. We always say to entrepreneurs, who you see is who you get. You know, our career is as venture investors. We are neither of us looking to take a role in the corporate host. And I think what really played into that for us is the structure that we have at REV. From day one, we have been a single LP GP fund. So we pay carry interest. We invest in 10 plus 2 year long-term funds. So we have a series of Delaware limited partnerships. So it's in fact, it comes onto our balance sheet and then from our balance sheet into our companies, and we account on a partnership basis. So we don't make a profit and therefore distributable returns until we've paid back the capital, the preferred return and the management fee costs of running the entire ventures program. And so we are a VC for all intents and purposes with a single LP. And we chose that structure from the very beginning purposely, and Reed Elsevier as it then was, or RELX as it is now, were very forward thinking back in 2000 to recognize that the best way to recognize with us that the best way to operate anything with that was working with entrepreneurs and other investors was to be symbiotic with them and to have the same alignment with them with the same compensation profile. So our long-term compensation comes from making money from the portfolio, which in turn comes from supporting entrepreneurs to be as successful as they possibly can. So we're entirely aligned with the other investors and the management teams as they build their businesses and particularly the entrepreneurs. And from day one, having that structure put us into a completely different category as an investor with a corporate ownership to every other corporate, what you might call corporate fund of that era, and indeed this era. I mean, there's very few corporate funds that have got the LPGP structure.
Yeah.
And it removed in those days anyway, where there were a lot of corporate investors that got into the market, got out. It removed all those questions from the table from entrepreneurs as we first got to meet them.
Yeah, I'd like to re-emphasize that and agree with that, Tony, because the model of or having an annual budget or having a 2 or 3 years budget from a corporate of we're going to do this investing, I think doesn't give that sort of commitment. And we've seen about 200 corporates per year coming in to doing corporate venture capital is the sort of stats from GCV and from CB Insights, and a massive percentage of them are going to just drop out, and they don't survive more than 2 or 3 years because the corporate patience and that misalignment and all the stuff you've just talked about, just re-emphasizing that, is so important.
And we found that has been really beneficial to ensuring that we as a partnership have got a very long-term view on this, and two, that we can hire very good talent in as associates and principals into the fund because they understand they're working in the venture industry. They're not this is not part of a career path into any part of Rolex, and that's a very different approach that we have, I think, to many other corporately sponsored funds. But it does make it very clear and crisp as to, one, what we do, two, how we get compensated, and three, where our allegiances lie. Our allegiances are to ensure that our portfolio is the very best it possibly can be. Now, the way we square that, because this is the question that people ask, is how do you balance strategic and financial? That's always the big question. Well, how we do that is we think of VCs as spending roughly a third of their time fundraising, which is a relatively low value add approach. You have a pitch deck, you go around, you tell them the returns and so on. What we do is we spend that equivalent amount of time, which is roughly 3 out of every 10 hours, in strategic dialogue across Rolex Group. So in individual operating units, at business unit level, at divisional level, and at the corporate level, in a range of activities. It could be strategic planning, where we'll have done a bit of work on market mapping and sort of looking at where money is flowing and the kind of technologies, business models, and talent pool shifts that are going on in a particular space. It may well be we've picked out some long-term trends, which we do periodically. We've probably done that 4 or 5 times over that era. A few years back, we did something called The Anatomy of a Digital Native, where we did a full analysis of how incumbents are being massively threatened and dislodged by insurgents across 9 dimensions, of the three big ones being sort of data and data under park and the analytic layer and the change of business models. And we drove out a whole lot of case studies using our associates to demonstrate how traditional businesses were being massively challenged and outgunned and outplayed by insurgents into their markets. And that was a higher level strategic involvement, where we took that across each of the main divisions and down into the operating units. And so that's one end of the spectrum we do. And the other end of the spectrum is being very responsive to individual requests that come out of business units. You can imagine in a group the size of Rolex, you've got 32,000 people worldwide working across multiple markets. So you've got legal, you've got science, you've got banking, you have insurance, you have aviation, you have agriculture, and there's even a very big exhibitions group. And there's a big kind of health markets group which operates kind of worldwide there. So, you know, you're covering many multiple important verticals, and they are a data and analytics provider to those verticals. So they're providing in real time information in the case of risk, of background profiles and entry exit and anti money laundering. Or in the case of Elsevier, what they're doing is they have a huge number of primary scientific journals, as well as an index of all the journals that are out there, and the ability to help governments understand their spend and return on scientific study and expenditure. You know, you have legal, where they advise, you know, they help lawyers better, you know, run their practices by providing precedent information and legal, deep legal research around litigation and practical law advice and those kinds of things. So they're kind of very deep in their market. And we'll get inbound requests to, across all of those markets about, you know, companies that they've seen, have we seen them, you know, what's our take on these markets, how would we respond if we're on the board of these companies. We get very tactical questions along the way as well. And what we do is we wrap that whole thing up into sort of the availability to hopefully add value through our insight of understanding how entrepreneurs work, how funding works, and how the VC world is operating and where that market is going and quite how they're looking to disrupt. What we don't do is ever share individual company information. We're not trying to be kind of a spy on the world or anything like that. We never share any company information unless we're asked to pass on a piece of information from a company that wants to get to know one of the operating units. What we're doing is we're trying to extract the data and the analysis from looking at a broad number of industries with a huge number of companies per year, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 per year. And so we're trying to flip the model, in you like, because there's a model of venture investing from corporates. It says, we're going to invest in one or two great companies that are going to change the way our corporate host works. We're going to find the needles in the haystack, silver bullet, and that's going to, we're going to suddenly find the answer. What we did is we recognized that was a very, very long shot in any industry. It's a long shot in venture industry to find a successful company in the first place, let alone one that's going to be both successful and transformative to the corporate host. Then you're kind of beginning to narrow down to an end of, you know, in the nano region of all the companies you're going to, as a percentage of all the companies you're ever going to meet. So we flip that model. So say, yeah, we're going to look at 2,000 or 3,000 companies a year. We can understand how that's shaping markets. We can understand individually by market how they compare. We can see how much money's going in. We can look at the kind of how users are changing their expectations. We can look at how business models are changing, how talent pools are shifting. You know, there's a number of dimensions on which RELX needed to reinvent. Only one of which was technology, as I mentioned at the beginning. The others around business model, user experience, and those kinds of things. So I'll give you a great example of that. In the early part of the portfolio, some of the things that we were seeing was how users were wanting to consume data and information in a completely different way than the editorialized function. And in particular, where you had any kind of data that was in electronic format, the way you'd search it was through Boolean algebra, Boolean expressions, which these days I don't think even people know what they are. But it's sort of figuring out which data set to use and what question to ask of which data set. And we said, well, no, the world is moving like a Google interface. You know, people are just going to want to go into one simple interface and access the information. So that was a piece of information, that came out of understanding not just obviously Google, but all the new entrants to all those markets had sort of these single one-line interfaces to their quite complex knowledge infrastructures. And it took a long time for the traditional professional information companies to catch up to that, because they had got professional customers using Boolean search and those kinds of things. So there are a number of things that you can extract as you kind of invert that pyramid and you look at all these companies. You can start to join the dots on user X, user experience. You can look at funding models. You can look at business models. You can look at kind of the talent pools, how you extract the right leadership, how you incent the right people. And all of those are the kinds of learnings that are just as useful when you're talking to how a business unit of RELX needs to reinvent. In fact, they're more useful because you're giving tools and examples and case studies of how organizations have operated versus needing to buy this company or buy that company to make the success. So that's how we kind of inverted that model over the years. And that's how we work with RELX and have continued to work with RELX over those years on that 3 out of 10 hours model, and periodically raising new funding from them and showing them real financial returns, so that we became a profitable unit within RELX whilst delivering the kind of advice coming and insight from the private market you couldn't get any other way. You couldn't get that from bankers, you certainly couldn't get that from consultants, and you could only get that from operating within the context of the entrepreneur's environment.
Subscribe for the podcast and you can join us for part two, when we discuss with Tony the impact and mitigation of the pandemic on venturing and corporates. Thank you.